any sort of sports museum is going to get their hardcore fans weeping over old jerseys, kind of a thing. But the idea might be if there's an idea of broadening that narrative a little bit, talking about sport, not just the thing that happens on the field or on the ice or on the pitch, but that it's part of a larger social and societal structure, that it does have a history that didn't happen in a vacuum.
This is The Public. The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you like what you hear, or if you don't, we're eager to hear from you. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. Today on The Public, we're speaking with Professor Greg Ramshaw about history, heritage, and sports, and about the commodification of nostalgia. Born and raised in Edmonton, Gregory Ramshaw is an assistant professor in the Department of Parks, Recreation, and Tourism Management at Clemson University, South Carolina. He's taught and written extensively about the social and cultural implications of heritage-based tourist attractions, including articles on diaspora tourism and homeland attachment, the commodification of heritage, and has taught a course on the philosophy of parks, recreation, and tourism management. He's focused particularly on sport heritage sites, and in fact his doctoral dissertation was titled The Construction of Sports Heritage Attractions. Prior to life in the academy, he worked at Western Canada's largest living history museum, dressing up in costume and pretending it was 1846 for visiting tourists. Dr. Greg Ramshaw, thanks very much for being with us today.
Hi, Mike. Thanks. Pleasure to be here.
Let's start with a very broad question.
Sure.
What's the difference between history and heritage?
Well, there are entire entire books written about that. But sometimes you tend to see heritage and history used interchangeably, and quite often heritage is seen as bad history. I'm not a historian per se, but I think in many respects history is that critical examination of the history in its own context. So if we're examining something in the 14th century or the 16th century, it tends to be, I think, confined to there. And what did they think? How did they react? What was taking place at that period of time? Whereas I see heritage as the present use of the past, and that can, and its construction can come from a lot of different places, and it might come from places like history or archaeology, traditional disciplines. It can also come from nostalgia. It can come from memory. It can come from fiction. And the idea between that, with that present use of the past, is that we're putting this, mixture together and using it for something now. Now, that could be economic development in terms of tourism. That could be political uses, either forwarding a particular political ideology. Heritage is often used for that. Can be used in education, certainly. But the idea is that it's very much tailored to what we need now. So if we're going to be looking at something like heritage tourism, we may keep those narratives from the past that are saleable, that may interest a particular tourist market, and we may discard those things that may not necessarily be useful to now, to today. Similar thing with politics. When the politics of heritage are used, we tend to we'll use those aspects from the past. We'll cherry pick them for what we need now. And that, again, as I say, might be to do with forwarding a particular political ideology. So the idea isn't that it's a critical examination of the past, but more that how we use the past today.
I see. So are heritage and history then studied differently? Is heritage of recreation, for instance, or sports studied differently than the history of politics or religion or architecture, what have you?
Yeah, I would say so. And I mean, in many respects, when I teach here at Clemson, when I teach a heritage course, I'm not necessarily referring to, you know, let's talk about the 19th century here in South Carolina, or let's talk about the 1930s. We're more looking at the idea of, okay, we have this building, we have this tradition, we have this festival. What are they putting together, and why are they calling it heritage? Where is this coming from? What are they trying to accomplish today? So in something like a sports site, you know, they'll use history. Obviously, history can, you know, particularly in sports, is one of the ingredients. But, you know, people bring their own memories. But sport is great for that, and a lot of sports sites are interesting for that. So, you know, if we take a Canadian example, something like the 1972 Summit Series, right? So classic sort of idea, you know, the Paul Henderson goal. There's the history behind that. There's obviously, the history would probably focus more on Cold War relations at that time. Whereas the heritage now, you know, we're thinking about it as a moment of Canadian identity, of a way that we came together. Even for those of us who didn't experience it firsthand, there's this idea called flashbulb memories, and sport is really great for this. In that, you know, people of our generation who are too young to necessarily experience that firsthand, we've seen that goal many, many times. And we may have formed our own memories around it, our own nostalgia, even though we weren't necessarily there. And sport being one of those things that are, you know, some of the most covered media events in the world, we can experience these things vicariously even many decades after the fact. We can form an attachment. I think we can form a nostalgia around them to a degree.
So the study of heritage then is the understanding of the connections of the present to incidents in the past, whether remembered or experienced through media or otherwise?
Sure, yeah. I mean, it can be all sorts of things. You know, one of the examples that I use with my students here, trying to draw an American example, is I use the example of Benjamin Franklin. And Benjamin Franklin, the historical Franklin, is quite complex. I mean, he was very much a British loyalist for a long time. He had an interesting background in terms of you know, at that time in the early United States, that was complex, and it's tied together with that period and the politics and the of that period. The heritage Franklin is one of founding father, of ingenuity, of thrift, of scientific discovery, all these things that tell us a little bit more about, you know, perhaps an aspirational element of American identity today. So that's very different than the historical Franklin. And so there's a fantastic book called The Americanization of Benjamin Franklin. In many respects, that's the idea of taking the historical Franklin, who was quite complex, and turning him into this symbolic beacon of contemporary American identity. So, yeah, I mean, it's a nuanced element, but in many respects, they're quite different.
And sports would lend itself tidily to that sort of recasting or recontextualization of the narrative, what with the elements of antagonism, good versus evil, lots of challenges to overcome, all sorts of metaphors from the gridiron to down to the last yard, and every other metaphor for business comes from sports, I'm pretty sure.
Oh, sure, absolutely. And I mean, again, that you know, if you go you know, not too far from where you are, and if you go down to the Hockey Hall of Fame, for example,
just
right?
A jaunt down the road from here.
Just down the road from you. And, I mean, you go into, it's been a few years since I've been there, but, you know, you will get an impression of the history of the sport. But it's not there to say, you know, here are the complex political or class relations that took place in the development of the NHL or professional hockey. I mean, I think that very much is the remit of the historian. You might get a hint of that, right? But when you go there, you're going to have an element of the major artifacts, the major events, those things that even, you know, there's an experiential component to heritage, I think, as well. Obviously, in the case of a lot of sports museums, the Hockey Hall of Fame being one of them, is, you know, shoot a puck or stop a puck or, you know, that sort of, you know, trying this thing out. But there's also that reflection as well. There's the idea of connecting oneself to the artifact. You know, I recall when I was there a few years ago with my wife, you know, I was telling stories and sort of waxing lyrical about different artifacts and so forth. And I came out and I said, was there anything that you knew there that, you know, if you went by yourself, would it be something that you could necessarily get a history of the game. She said, no, it was all through you. It was all through your memories and your background and everything else. So that sort of more existential sides of heritage, I suppose, are what makes sport particularly fertile ground for heritage.
Is the fact that the individual, the spectator, plays an important role in its performance.
Absolutely, and the fact that in many respects, I mean, you think about it now, it's a commodity. I mean, the heritage, you know, obviously in the case of a museum or Hall of Fame, that's a commodity. But the NHL using that the idea of the heritage and the traditions of the outdoor rink, and putting that into a major event like the Winter Classic or the Heritage Classic. I mean, they've and a lot of other leagues have done that since really in the last 10 years. There have been a couple hundred outdoor hockey games in different leagues. There are pond hockey championships, those sorts of things that, you know, play off of this version of the past, and sometimes it's a romanticized version. But clearly, you know, cherry-picking these elements of the past to put together something even as a product today.
So what is it about sports then and their ability to be cherry-picked to create this heritage? What is it about our collective experience of them that they create such deep emotional connections and thus lend themselves to these other purposes, this utility or use of that heritage?
Well, I guess, and I think you sort of hit the nail on the head there, that collective experience, right? And again, you know, that idea of the flashball memory that you don't even necessarily have had to experience it firsthand, that you can create a memory or recreate that connection with events that may have been, you know, predated, your own experience. And that makes sport, I think, again, one of those things that are, you know, is really fertile ground for this. I also think, as I say, the commodified aspect, you know, we have retro jerseys. Right, you know, the fact that sport, for certain people in their lives, also reflects makes them think of childhood. I remember Ken Dryden saying, you know, great Montreal Canadiens goaltender, who said the glory years of any sport is whenever you were 12 years old, or at least, you know, your first initial elements of fandom. And yeah, you know, if we take a historical view, it's interesting as we just went through the labor disputes that we have in, you know, be it, you know, NFL or NHL or NBA, there's this hearkening back to a time that was simpler. Well, it wasn't necessarily, you know, any more simple. Any historian will tell you that there were tremendous issues that happened in sports in the 50s, 60s, 70s, 80s, etc. But the heritage value of them, we think about them as being an antidote to the present, right? So we think about, you know, players are overpaid and they're not tied to necessarily to a location. And, you know, if I see someone come in at 18 years old into my team, I'm not going to see them through until they're 38 and retire. You know, they're going to move for the highest buck. And back then it was great and it was fantastic. Well, that's a commodity. I mean, if you can create something that harkens back, that seems to be a bit of an antidote to the present. And heritage does that quite often. It becomes this, a little bit, it becomes something comforting. It becomes something reassuring, and it allows us to feel that all is still good.
So you've explained very tidily and wrapped up in a neat bow, thank you, mm-hmm. the purpose heritage serves for society or the culture surrounding it, but what is the purpose of the heritage activity surrounding sports teams and for the sports teams themselves? It must be more than just selling jerseys or tickets.
Well, it's interesting. You know, a few years ago, I did a study on the Heritage Classic event, the first one that took place in Edmonton between the Edmonton Oilers and the Montreal Canadiens. And that was put on not by the NHL, but the Edmonton Oilers actually organized that. And when I talked to the organizers, the people involved in it, the idea in many respects was, there was that sort of, wouldn't it be great if we took it back to its roots? Wouldn't it be great to create this this spectacle? And part of the idea was, from their perspective, one, it was, utilizing that path to create a new product, A second thing was an idea to tide over their fans. If you recall, you know, the Oilers have not been a particularly successful team for some time.
It's been a while.
So they, you know, the organizers, when I spoke to them, said, you know, it had been a while since we'd done a cup run. It had been, it didn't look like we were going to have that here. Let's do something for our loyal fans to say, you know, we still love you. You're still fantastic. Let's do that. I think the other thing was, and I think this came about maybe after the event was announced and when it took on really a life of its own, and it was an international media event. You have to remember at that time, it was 10 years ago, but that was a really unique event. So there was covered from many different perspectives, from many different angles. I mean, you had columnists coming from Boston, from New York, from Detroit, from Los Angeles, from Finland, from Sweden. I mean, it was an international media event. And in many ways, the idea was it maybe kind of put Edmonton on the map. It was a bit of civic pride as well. And again, those sorts of things, it's utilizing a past. It's bringing Gretzky back to the pond in which he grew up on and all that sort of stuff. But it served a few different purposes. Again, economic, maybe creating a bit of emotional capital as well. And, a bit of pride in city as well. And I think that's not unlike a lot of events. But I would say, I mean, you can be a little bit cynical about these things. And they are great events, and quite often these retro sorts of products, these heritage-based products, can be great. But they are ultimately products in some respects.
You spoke about that event being a major media draw, mm-hmm. and drawing columnists from all across the continent. To what degree do you think broadcast and now internet technologies have changed the way current events are consumed and consequently heritage is created, constructed, applied?
Well, it's interesting. You know, I was just thinking about this week. Of course, they've had there's been a major sort of heritage event this week in the town of Leicester in England, where the remains of Richard III were found.
Mm-hmm.
And obviously that became a major media story almost instantly. You know, it was trending on Twitter. I saw lots of people posting it on Facebook. It was front page of most, you know, sort of major news organizations, or at least their websites. The interesting component is within about a day, there were already plans, and it was basically announced that there was going to be a heritage tourism component to it for the town of Leicester. That the idea of the time between the discovery and the commodification of that discovery through tourism was nearly instantaneous. And I think in some ways that does reflect a little bit of that connection. And it's not necessarily a sport example, but I've heard about it, I want to see it, I want to go to it. And maybe that connection, whereas it may have taken a number of years before, or the news filters out and maybe we'll go find this place, now it's almost instantaneous. As soon as the discovery was found, as soon as it became a worldwide story, you know, Tuesday you can come see something, you know, or within a year you're going to be seeing something more. And for a place like a Leicester, and I've been to Leicester, I apologize to anyone from Leicester who might be listening, there isn't a lot of in terms of an attraction there. And so maybe one of the things that it can happen with this is that you create something not something out of nothing, but you can put yourself on the map. And that's one of the things that heritage does. It was one of the things, and in retrospect, was one of the elements that created the Heritage Classic, that you did have that broadcast media, that they were there, and there is a way of putting a place on the map. If you watched any of the London Olympics, and London is not a place that necessarily lacks for tourists or necessarily lacks for any form of heritage tourism. You know, as Samuel Pepys said, once you're bored of London, you're bored of life, and it's a great city. But you notice that many of the events were held in heritage locations with heritage backdrops. So you had you know, the pan away beach volleyball. Beach volleyball was at Whitehall. There's Big Ben right in the background. Equestrian was held at the National Maritime Museum and the Royal Observatory in Greenwich. There it is. You pan away. You see Christopher Wren's beautiful hospital. It's a heritage place. You know, it's a place attachment there. Archery was held at Lord's, the cricket ground. You know, so these sorts of things do tie together, and there is that, really, that, I think, connection between heritage and broadcast. I think, you know, they weren't putting these out in the suburbs with nothing behind them.
So I have a couple of questions to follow up on that one. The first is about putting communities on the map.
Sure.
You spoke about Leicester and the recent discovery there of the remains of Richard III. Now, that actually happened. What about the heritage that small towns, particularly in the Canadian West, apply to themselves to acquire heritage and an identity? I'm thinking of Torrington, Alberta, and its Gopher Hole Museum with all the taxidermied gophers as dressed up like beauticians and blacksmiths and all sorts of interesting things. Giant Easter eggs on sticks.
Sure.
How does that fit into the narrative?
Well, the interesting thing is, and it's funny you mentioned that. I mean, the heritage is one of those things, and I mean, you know, obviously those things, I'm not sure they're necessarily put out there as heritage. Maybe they acquire some sort of heritage value. You know, the one I remember that we always had to stop at in growing up in Alberta was in the town of Vegreville and seeing the Pasanka, the Ukrainian Easter egg, the largest Pasanka in the world.
Mm-hmm.
So we had to go visit that every time. These sort of roadside attractions. But it's interesting because the heritage is one of those things that you can be one of the elements of rural tourism development. And what we're seeing a lot in heritage tourism, in fact, I'm working on a project here in South Carolina looking at something similar to this, are the, you know, the heritage trail concept. So it's not necessarily that you go to the Gopher Museum, but maybe the Gopher Museum is one of the stops that you have in a larger, you know, understanding heritage in a larger landscape that might tie it to something to do with wildlife, maybe. You know, the ones we see here in the U.S., there's a Blues Trail, a Delta Blues Trail. There's a Bluegrass Trail in Kentucky. There are, the one I'm working on right now, and it's very much in its infancy, is a seafood trail in South Carolina. And part of that is, you know, in my case, is maybe tying the idea of the food, you know, the farm-to-plate kind of movement, the idea of, you know, having shrimp that just came off of the shrimp boat at a local rural restaurant. And that can be a heritage in and of itself. I mean, heritage isn't just bricks and mortar. In fact, it's very rarely bricks and mortar.
Yeah, it's all about the individual's experience there.
Yeah, very much about the experience, but the idea is not necessarily about the shrimp. It's the value you put in the shrimp, right? Or it's the value you put in a building. I mean, any building doesn't necessarily have inherent heritage values. Those are created by us. And, you know, not to get too theoretical, but there's a long line of things saying that all heritage is intangible because heritage is just values, right? That's not about the old building, it's the values we put in that old building. Nevertheless, so, you know, with rural tourism, you know, a lot of these with rural tourism development, as you know, and this is probably the case in parts of Ontario as well, there are small towns that are going away, that are dying, that are changing. Maybe they once had an industry and that industry is gone. And heritage is one of those things that may be a way of at least keeping something going there. And again, if you can develop it with a trail in mind, you know, that you get someone off the highway to come see your museum, and they may see they'll follow a particular line and see another museum, you know, that follows a similar narrative. It can help in that. It's not going to replace heavy industry. It's not going to replace those sorts of things. But, heritage is one of the things that it kind of everyone has. And it might be a way of tying it together and creating something out of it.
So in the commercial exchange, then, that describes the sellers. You've written that, quote, contemporary understandings of heritage and heritage tourism have focused less on the perceived validity of the pasts being presented at and by heritage venues and more on the contemporary needs and values that heritage meanings serve. Mm-hmm. So in terms of the buyer, I should say, mm-hmm. what are those needs and values that people that people seek out in heritage sites?
It's, you know, I'll put it to you this way. I always tell this to my students. If you can figure out what the tourist needs and wants, then you're you should set yourself up as a consultant, and you can
license to print money, I suppose.
You pretty much print money as you go. I mean, that, you know, we have this idea that tourists come, and it doesn't matter whether it's heritage or otherwise, that tourists come, that they have a primary reason for coming, they have a secondary reason, that they have a tertiary reason. And obviously, any of us can think of a journey that we've had where we're sometimes heritage tourists, sometimes sport tourists, sometimes we're just interested in going to the casino, and maybe we're gambling tourists. You know what I mean? I mean, we don't fit really well into these niches. What we've seen in heritage is that people will come to these things for a variety of reasons. Sometimes they'll get dragged to them, you know, by friends and family. Sometimes it's because grandma's in town and they wanted to show off that place. Sometimes it's pride. Sometimes it's nostalgia. Sometimes it's a form of education, trying to, you know, learn about a place. That's quite often the case. You know, depending on the museum, it might be, you know, a large national museum or an urban museum. It might be because it's rainy out and I have to entertain the kids. We tend to think of these things that people come in with as blank slates, and that the museum or the interpreter or the, you know, the heritage interpreter or the site fills them up with knowledge and they leave, you know, enlightened. And obviously people bring their own experiences, and that can be for a variety of reasons. The site in Edmonton that you mentioned in your introduction, I mean, people came there for all sorts of reasons. And some of it might have been education, and some of it might have been, again, because grandma's in town from England. And, one of the things I think we've seen in heritage a lot is that transference from, that these are places, you know, they're almost on a pedestal, that they are something above and beyond any other sort of activity. Well, in many respects now, heritage attractions are, you know, competing directly with other leisure industries. Are we going to go to the city museum, or are we going to go to the IMAX? And quite often those aren't seen as separate things.
What's the relationship then between, aside from fraught, between museums and heritage? In your article, The Marginalization of Paralympic Heritage, you write, sports museums are shrines where people go to worship sports heroes. Museums are ultimately shrines to the great man theory of history, to the neglect of community-level individual participation. Does heritage confound that or challenge that understanding of the progress of history?
Oh, absolutely. And I think, you know, one of the things that has tended to take place, particularly in sports museums, is that they tended to be follow the Hall of Fame model. So it here are the great moments of our sports past. Come and see the great people, and you know it's very much about veneration. Heritage is one of those interesting things that, again, I've tended to talk about in fairly positive elements, that what we've inherited from the past and what we tend to pass along, those sort of contemporary uses, tend to be fairly, you know, positive, or they tend to follow fairly positive heritages. I mean, we've inherited lots of stuff from the past that is negative, and sports certainly has done that. And I think one of the things that sports museums could do, and I'm not sure to the extent to which they do, there's some reluctance, at least a number of the curators that I talk to, there's some reluctance to talk about, you know, racism or sexism or homophobia or those sorts of things that are part of a sports heritage, right? I mean, it's one thing to go to a museum and you're going to get, any sort of sports museum is going to get their hardcore fans, right? They're going to get the people who are, you know, and I'm certainly part of this as well, you know, weeping over old jerseys kind of a thing. The idea might be if there's an idea of broadening that narrative a little bit, talking about sport, not just the thing that happens on the field or on the ice or on the pitch, but that it's part of a larger social and societal structure, that it does have a history that didn't happen in a vacuum. You know, you can not only, you know, talk about those narratives to people who may not necessarily be traditional museum goers or arts or cultural consumers, but also maybe, you know, again, very much a bottom line sort of a thing, but maybe get people in who don't necessarily have an interest in the sport or have a nominal interest in the sport. I mean, if you have a baseball museum, you're going to get hardcore baseball fans there. But if you talk about maybe something where the heritage of, you know, some of the class-based heritage or some of the gender-based heritage that's there, maybe you get someone who kind of is not really that interested in baseball but is interested in those wider sort of structures. You're going to get, I think you're going to get the baseball fans in there anyway. I think, you know, you might be able to kill two birds with one stone in terms of representing a broader heritage as well as maybe getting in a different museum patron as well.
I know that living in South Carolina, you're somewhat removed from the Canadian national dialogue, I'll call it.
Sure.
But being Canadian and something of a politics buff, can you comment on what Stephen Harper is doing lately, reconstructing the Canadian narrative? He's transplanting peacekeepers and replacing them with a projection of military power. He's leaning heavily on hockey heritage.
Mm-hmm.
What contemporary needs and values, what purpose is he looking to serve, and do you think he'll be ultimately successful?
Well, some of my old colleagues, sociologists at the University of Alberta, talked a little bit about this connection between militarism and sport. It's not something I would have a tough time thinking about or talking about the idea of whether or not he would necessarily be successful at it. But think about some of the things that that are taking place right now, you know, and outside of the sport realm. But for example, the tremendous amount of federal dollars that went into the War of 18, the bicentennial of the War of 1812 this year, and you probably saw that a lot in Ontario.
Mm-hmm.
You know, at a time when Parks Canada and related heritage agencies are having a tremendous funding time, there's, you know, tens of millions of dollars being poured into that. And I think, you know, tying those, you know, what is commonly seen in Canada as a you know, a victory over America and this sort of sense of independence serves a very contemporary, contemporary concern, right?
Mm-hmm.
Be that, something about Canadian pride, about Canadian nationalism, about beating up on the big brother sort of thing. What will be very interesting, I think, is to see what the current government does with the centennial of the First War, which, of course, is such a major part of the Canadian historical narrative, but has perhaps been forgotten a bit in terms of the heritage narrative. And it'll be very interesting to see how that is actually played into this connection between politics and, obviously, our military past and our contemporary heritage needs.
Yeah, Canada's role in the First World War doesn't distill so neatly down to a single element as does the War of 1812. Maybe that's
sure.
The benefit of 200 years, though.
Sure, absolutely. And I mean, you know, I think, and again, you see, I think there's a very, and again, you know, being a little bit removed from it, there seems to have been a fairly targeted element of where to put those heritage dollars. I mean, the renovation of the Vimy Memorial, for example, is something that obviously is a big part of our national identity, and so it will be interesting to see what happens. And certainly, yeah, I mean, not being necessarily a political science scholar, but there's probably a lot to do with tying that sort of hockey heritage narrative. I mean, I noticed that, he's apparently finally, the Prime Minister's finished his hockey book.
It's due out in the fall.
There you go. And I mean, I think for a lot of people, and I think a lot of the sociologists, Canadian sports sociologists that I read, thought this thing was a myth. So I guess it has to be something real now. But the fact that is part of the narrative, again, I think it reflects very strongly on maybe who he is or who he perceives to want to be, and certainly the role that hockey plays in contemporary Canadian identity is interesting. As we talk, I was looking that it's actually today on the, as we're taping this, is Hockey Day in Canada, a celebration of hockey in Canada. I think, goodness me, isn't that every day? I'm not sure it necessarily needs its own day.
It needs sponsors, though. If you make
absolutely, but there again, it's using, and it's the small towny kind of. It's very nostalgic and it's very romantic and it's very appealing. I mean, certainly, even the idea of something like the outdoor rink. Goodness me, I grew up on the outdoor rink. I was probably the last generation to grow up on the outdoor rink. I don't think too many. Kids play on the outdoor rink. Maybe I'm wrong with that. It might be old fogies like me trying to recapture our former glory because we can't afford indoor ice.
Right. Well, you've written about Calgary's Olympic legacy. Calgary hosted the Winter Olympics in 88, of course, and they've since repurposed the infrastructure into Olympic sport, heritage museums, and training grounds. The stated goal is to enable and cultivate the next generation of Olympic athletes, but at the same time, they're steering the city and its values away from established sporting and cultural values like hockey towards luge and bobsleigh, which are much more European. Are they using sports heritage to engineer their culture?
I think it's interesting, and the Calgary Olympics are a really fascinating case study. And since I wrote that article a few years ago, they've actually built a brand new facility there in the Canada Sports Hall of Fame in the same location as Canada Olympic Park. But one of the things that came very strongly out of that study, and you'll see this in any kind of Olympic bid, is that it's not just about the 2 weeks; it's about the 20 years after that. It's all about legacy, right? So one of the legacies I think Calgary really wanted to position itself as, and certainly when you have large-scale facilities like they do at Canada Olympic Park, which include a bobsleigh, a luge, a ski jump run that can't be used anymore because I think the ski jump technology has overshot the.
Oh, really?
It's a bit of a derelict property now. At least that section of it. From my understanding, they'd have to dig a whole new landing bowl to be able to keep up with the current. Abilities of international ski jumpers, but one of the things that came across very strongly there is when I was doing that study is we don't want this place just to be a relic of a game that no one remembers, and we want to talk about that we are a contemporary international training facility, that we are involved in. At the time I did that, the Vancouver Olympics, Winter Olympics, were still upcoming. So they said, we were very much about, future Olympic performance. As well as the fact that the Calgary Olympics, I think, were certainly one of the defining events for that city. Calgary, I get the impression now, obviously Calgary has grown substantially since 1988, that there's a lot of influx, a lot of new people living in Calgary, and maybe one of the things that facility does in terms of creating a heritage, creating a culture, is almost indoctrinating these new, often young, transplants about the importance of the Olympics in Calgary's identity, how it is still part of it. Contemporary culture. I mean, I noticed that we're talking, some of the Canadian media are talking about, that we're 1 year out from Sochi, the Sochi Olympics, and, who will be on the, say, Canadian men's hockey team. And certainly I would think that those training camps or whatever they happen to be will probably be held in Calgary. They often are, that Calgary positions itself, even subsequently even after Vancouver, Calgary really positions itself as the home of the Canadian Olympic movement. And that facility plays into that. And its use as a contemporary training facility reinforces that claim. I mean, if that didn't exist anymore, Calgary would have a tough time saying that, right?
Hmm. So in terms of sports franchises and sports facilities in municipal development, then, you've written about how declining federal support for cities, at least in the United States, has led to renewed municipal government-level interest in sports heritage and sports facilities. Would you speak to that and the dynamic at play?
Sure, and I mean it's an interesting it's an interesting thing because sport heritage. I'm talking about it and been talking about it often as a commodity and something that is a product and so forth, and quite often it's not always a successful product. So I'll give you an example. A couple hours up the road from me in Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Charlotte Convention and Visitors Bureau invested a tremendous amount of money into creating a it's called the NASCAR Hall of Fame. And so it's a beautiful facility. Actually, you'd never know it was NASCAR from the outside. It almost looks like a Guggenheim or, you know, like a modern art museum. Maybe that's part of the problem. But
doesn't really target their demographic.
No, not exactly. And there's been quite a few problems with it, not the least of which is, NASCAR fans tend to drive either larger vehicles or motorhomes, and there's literally no place to park them anywhere around there. So it makes the pilgrimage a little bit more difficult. But the idea was with this is that it was in part meant to create a year-round destination in downtown Charlotte. And downtown Charlotte's very nice, but there are not a lot of go-to attractions, and this was one of the go-to attractions. And the idea behind this was that it was going to attract, the estimates were when they opened, 800,000 visitors in its inaugural year and draw approximately 400,000 visitors every year after. It has come nowhere near those numbers. 800,000 visitors to a paid museum would put it somewhere in the top 100 of museums in the world. And so I think it drew about 300 in its first year, and it's hovered around 150,000, 175,000 since then. And so these things can be, it's lost money. And so these things can be a bit of a gamble, at least in trying to develop them strictly for tourism. I think the discourse has changed a lot around urban facilities in the last 20 years. When Camden Yards was built in Baltimore, Maryland, which is a retro ballpark, sort of the first of the old-time ballparks, a lot of the discourse was around tourism, or around tourism development to a place that no longer had tourism development or didn't have any tourism. So, and it certainly developed some of that as well and certainly been an anchor for that. But you're never going to pay it off just on tourism. So I think any new sports facility has had to look at it being a little bit different. And I followed some of the arena debates in Edmonton from a distance. And of course, they've got a deal in place. Now I think they've got a shovel in the ground yet, but very few of those were actually around tourism development or attracting tourists. That's a help, but it was more around creating a better tax base in the downtown or revitalization for the people already in Edmonton or attracting new businesses or retaining the businesses that they had, but there wasn't really much around tourism. So that's, I think, a big change in the last 20 years.
In sports facilities and transnational corporations, which is a chapter in a book you wrote, a chapter you wrote in a book, you wrote that competition among cities to acquire or retain sports franchises has forced local governments to up the ante or risk losing their teams, despite evidence suggesting professional sports teams and their facilities provide little or no economic benefit to their host regions. So what's the value for a city in having those teams and facilities then?
I think one of the things that you tend to see it, the idea that it sort of coalesced around is it's one of those things that attracts and retains people and businesses, right? So, in a place like Toronto, it's a little bit different, I think, in terms of that you do have such a large city that there are so many head offices there that whether the Leafs exist or not probably is nice but doesn't really mean a lick.
Right.
In a smaller city, it's I think it changes the dynamic a little bit. That I think the idea that having an arena and say an NHL team or an NBA team is one of those check marks that you can put along having an art gallery and a symphony orchestra and a good theater and excellent parks and schools, right? So if you're going to attract people or businesses from around the world, that can be one of the things you can do. I live about 45 minutes from a place called Greenville, South Carolina. And Greenville is a town, the area is about 170,000. But they did an entirely redeveloped city center, which includes a beautiful minor league baseball stadium that is actually a replica of Fenway Park in Boston. And, you know, around the ballpark are bars and restaurants. There's an art walk and galleries. There's a beautiful little river system and waterfalls, and there's Shakespeare in the Park and the whole bit. Will it attract tourists? Yeah, it probably does. But one of the things that I think one of the reasons why it was built, and certainly one of the justifications why it remains and is popular, is because 15 minutes down the road is BMW's major North American manufacturing plant, as well as Michelin's head office. So if you're bringing someone over from Germany or from another part of the United States, and they're saying, well, where are we going? We're going to Greenville, South Carolina, never heard of it. But once they get there, once they see that there is the symphony, there is the sporting events, that there are, places where kids can go, or they can go out on a Friday night or whatever, it becomes a little bit more appealing that it's a place that can attract business and hopefully retain, smart people to live and work there. And I think that's one of the ideas, behind that. So the actual, the actual direct investment, whether or not an arena pays off directly might be a little bit of a challenge.
So what does the inclusion or reliance on sports teams in their facilities do to cultivate distinct identities for these cities? Or it sounds like that's not even the purpose.
Well, I'm not, and I suppose in some cases I think the sports facility or the sports team can. I think it obviously depends a little bit on the city. I think something like the Oklahoma City Thunder, the NBA team, has, again, the idea is always it puts us on the map, right? I think this is the big thing with the Winnipeg Jets coming back as well, is that does it bring you up a tier? Are all of a sudden you taken a little bit more seriously? One of the interesting things that took place around the Atlanta media when the Thrashers relocated wasn't necessarily a mourning at the loss of the hockey team exactly, as much as are they no longer, a top-tier U.S. city and, a top-tier U.S. sports city, that, we're not one of the cities that now have the big four professional sports. We've been knocked down a tier. So even in large cities like Atlanta, it can play a little bit of a role, though I think it depending on the size of the city, I think that changes the dynamic a little bit. And certainly, if there is a team that is very much defines the city, it can certainly be one of those things that if it's missing, if it's gone, stakes a blow to the identity and the feelings people have about that city, and that may have occurred in Winnipeg. It seems as though it did. It may still be there in Quebec City, and I think that's why, and I certainly lived through the 1990s in Edmonton when the team was leaving every other day, and the hockey team was, that there were public rallies with signs that said, "Stay Oilers, stay," and so it's probably as much a psychological blow than it would be, and a perception blow, maybe more than an actual economic blow.
In the title for this chapter, which is Sports Facilities and Transnational Corporations, Anchors of Urban Tourism Development, You describe sports facilities and their partnering transnational corporations, the food and beverage franchises in the stadia, as well as the surrounding shops and services, as anchors for urban tourism development. How conscious are corporations that they're enabling, facilitating our history and heritage by way of sport, as compared to purely entertaining us in the moment to sell us beer?
I'm not sure they're actually conscious in it at all. I mean, I would say that to the extent to which, I mean, heritage, I think, you know, one of the trains of thought that has been taking place in heritage studies are very much about the aesthetics of heritage. That heritage is very much a visual, something that's very visual and tangible in some ways, in that there isn't much depth to it, you know.
Right.
But it looks old and it kind of feels old-timey, and that's a good thing, right? So I'm not sure to what extent they're actually conscious of it, or necessarily that they even want to tie into it, right? So. You know, one of the interesting things is the renovations of Fenway Park that took place a few years ago. And Fenway Park being a historical ballpark, I mean, it's 100 years old this past year. And it certainly has a lot of heritage values to it and so forth. But part of that was also when they renovated it was creating a bit of a heritage aesthetic. So, you know, a lot of the signs there, you know, whether they're contemporary companies or not, look old-timey, right? That it was meant to feel a little bit old. It's almost replicating its own past. It's a very strange sort of simulacrum kind of thing. And there's an author named Michael Friedman who talked about the fact that Fenway Park went through a bit of a Camdenization. So Camden Yards being the replica of the old ballparks, but with modern amenities, whereas Fenway Park being an old ballpark, a cramped ballpark, but looked at utilizing its heritage to create different revenue streams, you know, be it, and part of that is that old-timey feeling, right? I'm not sure to what extent, you know, Budweiser wants to, you know, wax lyrical about its own past as much as looking like it aesthetically belongs in that location.
I'm wondering about... Given that sports franchises are seen as a vehicle for heritage, and municipalities see the benefit of having these heritage institutions within them to up their ante, to bring them up to the high rollers table, or at least up by one, and the corporations are certainly participating in this as well. And given that heritage is intangible, it's about values, it's about what we feel is important and how we shape our culture looking backwards and going forwards, what ethical considerations need to be kept in mind by the players? No, not the sports players, the different
actors in this sort of thing. Well, I guess the ethical considerations, and I'm not sure, quite sure if it would necessarily be ethical as much as representation, right? So, for example, most baseball museums here, or most baseball teams in the U.S. have some sort of, or many of them have, something that is a heritage attraction to them. And quite often it's a museum and a stadium tour, right? And for example, if you go to the... Atlanta Braves Museum at Turner Field in Atlanta, one of the things is it's a corporate museum. It's meant as a positive reflection on the franchise. So they're not going to necessarily talk about players who,
doping,
had PED allegations,
right,
against them. They're not going to talk about the tremendous debate around using Native American mascots and those sort of representational issues, right?
Right.
I mean, they've got Hank Aaron's home run baseball from when he beat Babe Ruth's record. I've got it in the museum. Now, in many respects, it celebrates a great achievement for a player. One of the things I know for me that made it very powerful is they had when there's a section in Ken Burns' documentary Baseball that came out about 20 years ago, where it has him hitting the home run, and the overlay, the soundtrack to it, were people reading the hate mail that he got, right? Like the absolute virulent racist emails or racist letters that he received, and that makes that achievement all the more heroic, right? But that may not necessarily be represented. It's a challenging past. It's something that, doesn't necessarily fit a happy, narrative. And I'm not sure necessarily it's an ethical issue as much as understanding what the purpose of that place is supposed to be. And that may not fit. Having a debate about the role of the mascot doesn't necessarily fit a museum that's supposed to be fairly laudatory about the franchise. So whether or not that's ethical, I mean, that's certainly a representational aspect that doesn't necessarily come through. And again, that can meet particular aims. That can meet, whether or not, let's say it's the Braves Museum sponsored by Coca-Cola. I mean, does Coca-Cola necessarily want to have that, right? I mean, there are those issues that come into particular ideas of representation.
Given that we exclude those considerations when we create these narratives, and we exclude all sorts of things about the nature of sport, I'm wondering about the ethics of sports heritage itself. I mean, competitive sport is necessarily, well, I shouldn't say that. I'm going to start over again.
Sure.
Competitive sport is the cultural glorification of constrained, granted, but still systematic violence in hockey, football, lacrosse, in pretty much every contact sport.
Sure.
And I wonder about the ethics of using sport as a cultural identifier, as the vehicle for our cultural values, and of this heritage process overall.
Well, I suppose you could talk about, most of what we think about as heritage maybe comes out of, probably comes out of some form of conflict, right? I mean, probably the national heritages that we have, that we memorialize, that we think about the most, are quite often those to do with war, right? And certainly the formation of nation coming through those as well. They also tend to be, as a colleague of mine says, rather dude focused, right? So I mean, they tend to exclude many, many different perspectives. Again, whether or not there's an ethical aspect to that, I think I might leave aside. I think one of the things that probably needs to occur, and to a greater or lesser extent it perhaps has, although I think it's a long ways away, are at least thinking about some of those representational issues. I know of at least one museum. It was a number of years ago. It was the tennis, International Tennis Hall of Fame at in New York. Did talk about, for example, athlete burnout in tennis and eating disorders and those sorts of things that take place with a sport that drives people into it, who are, quasi-professional at 12, 13, 14, 15, right? And maybe heritage could be, and certainly heritage places could be a way of interrogating. There have been many examples of the way that heritage can be used as not only just a glorification from the top down, but can actually be used as a subaltern means of resistance. And maybe sport needs that. Maybe sport heritage, there needs to be something that turns it on its ear a little bit that says, wait a minute, you haven't talked about these things. That this glorification of violence, that this glorification of this is part of it as well, and we have to talk about that as a legacy as well. To the extent that that's been done, is at least in sport, is rather nominal, I would say. It's been done, I would say, in other forms of heritage and other types of heritage. But again, that can be that can have its own problems. Once you sort of institutionalize something, particularly as heritage, it tends to fossilize it. But heritage doesn't allow a lot of things to grow and adapt.
The Public is a weekly conversation about ideas and undercurrents in Canadian culture on CIUT 89.5. If you have something you'd like to add, please be in touch. You can find us at thepublicconversation.blogspot.ca or through ciut.fm. You can also email us at thepublicconversation@gmail.com. That's our show this week. We hope you'll tune in again.